From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Bat maternity season starts tomorrow, which means if one has taken roost in your eaves, it's illegal to put up bat exclusion materials until after August 15th, the end of their maternity season. Today on the show, we're talking with a zoologist and a bat expert about these flying mammals who, whether you love them or fear them, are an important part of Florida's ecosystem. We'll also learn about the federally endangered bat species, which is only found right here in Southwest Florida. Plus, as high season winds down in Southwest Florida and snowbirds pack up and head north, restaurants and nonprofits look at dwindling sales and fewer contributions. In an effort to combat that, a local group created Naples Restaurant Week to bring attention to the local dining scene. They've partnered with the Naples Humane Society for an upcoming event called First Bite, which previews the dishes on offer during Restaurant Week while raising money for shelter animals. We'll talk with organizers about their uniquely united approach to keep businesses and charity going. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. This weekend marks the traditional end of Southwest Florida's high season, which lasts from Christmas to Easter. And while the drop-off into summer is getting less extreme as more and more year-rounders call the area home, it's still tough for businesses and charities when snowbirds fly north. Thus, the timing of Naples Restaurant Week, which sees a unique alliance between several restaurants and local charities. That story is coming up a little later in the show. But first, bats, the stuff of vampiric legend, night-flying carnivorous mammals, and also the subject of cute videos on social media. Wherever you fall on the spectrum of bat adoration, they are an important part of Florida's ecosystem, and right now is their maternity season. Notice has gone out from the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission that if a roosting bat has chosen your attic as its home, it's illegal to try to remove them until maternity season is over on August 15th. And there's a federally endangered bat species that calls Southwest Florida its only home. That bat is protected year-round. Joining us to talk about the bat's role in the greater environment is Dr. Jerry Jackson, a zoologist and FGCU professor. He also brings us With the Wild Things program, which is right here on WGCU. Jerry, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Also joining us is Dr. Holly Ober with the University of Florida, whose specialty is bats. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We are talking about bats. Do you have a question or a comment? You can become part of this conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. First, Dr. Jerry Jackson, tell me a little bit about what it is that bats do that makes them a protected animal during their maternity season.
Well, what protects them is the Endangered Species Act of 1973, and animals that have been included on the endangered species list. The protection given to them by the state, which is really good protection, they're protecting them during the maternal season, is something they're doing because it's humane. Bats are important to the ecosystem in which they live. You suggested they were carnivorous. They're not exactly carnivorous, although that's a correct term to use. It means eating meat, but they don't really eat meat. They eat insects.
Bug meat.
They're insectivorous.
Yeah.
And using the word insectivorous tells us a little bit more about them, and one of the reasons why it's important, because they consume an enormous quantity of insects, and many of those are insect pests that we'd like to not have around. Insect pests that affect our trees, our crops, our wildlife, our livestock, and some of them, the smallest ones, do eat lots and lots of mosquitoes.
So, I mean, they do have a valuable contribution to society.
Absolutely. A bat can nearly eat its weight in insects in a night.
That's a lot of insects.
Up to about – it's the equivalent of about 3,000 mosquitoes a night for – a small bat, a single small bat.
I would love for there to be a kind of bat that ate only mosquitoes, just to get rid of them.
Well, the eastern pipistrelle is one that eats a lot of mosquitoes.
Oh, that's funny. Pipistrelle is Italian for a bat. Dr. Holly Ober, you are keenly interested in bats. So tell me a little bit about how they live. Tell me there are two different types that are divided based on where they roost.
Okay, so we could actually categorize bats into three different places where they roost. And when we talk about roosting, we're talking about where the bats are sleeping during the day. So all of our bats in Florida are nocturnal, meaning that they are flying around actively foraging during the night, and during the day they are resting in a place that we call a roost. So there are some bats in Florida that roost in caves, not down in southwest Florida, but in more northern parts of the state. And then there's a second group of bats that roost in the foliage in trees, and then there's a third group that roost within the trunk of the tree, so either within cavities or underneath the bark as it starts peeling off dead and dying trees.
And those are the ones that end up in homes when they don't find a suitable tree?
Exactly. It's those tree roosting bats that really would prefer to be living within a cavity in a tree or underneath the bark. If they can't find those conditions, then they will go into buildings. So you can sometimes find them in attics or in outbuildings, in stadiums, in bridges and culverts and many other man-made structures that have similar characteristics as those trees that they would prefer to be in.
And so when people find out that they have a bat in their attic, for example, how do they get rid of them? I mean, I know they can't now, but how do they during the times when they can?
Well, you are allowed to do what's called an exclusion. So basically what this entails is putting up some type of structure that serves as a one-way door. So it would allow the bats to leave at sunset when they want to go out to forage, but then prevent them from getting back into the building at sunrise. So you could use some sort of screen or some sort of tube that would attach to the side of the building where the bats were getting in and out, and then attach it so that the bats can find their way out, but they're not able to get back in. And I do want to repeat again that you are not allowed to do that from April 15th to August 15th within the state of Florida. You can do it from August 15th to April 15th. So basically you're allowed to do it during the fall and winter, but you're not allowed to do it during the spring and summer when there could be babies or pups inside that building.
And the baby bats are called pups.
Yes.
I just think that's
and
great.
They can't fly during their first few weeks of their life. And so the reason you're not allowed to do an exclusion to prevent bats from getting back into a building between April 15th and August 15th is because then the pups would be inside and they wouldn't be able to fly, and so they would die inside the building. And that is both inhumane to the bats and also would result in a huge mess for the homeowner to have a series of dead bats inside the building.
So I want to ask first about the pups. You said that they can't fly for the first couple weeks. What would they do if they were in a tree? They just kind of hang there?
Yes. So the mothers will go out and feed, and then they'll return to the roost and feed them with milk because bats are mammals. So the first few weeks of life, the bats, the pups, are not feeding on insects. Instead, they're getting milk from their mother.
And then if you left them in the attic and you didn't, you know, if you didn't bother them, can they do damage up there?
They will be defecating, so they will be creating what we call guano, which is basically bat scat. The benefit of having a pile of bat guano is that you can potentially use it as fertilizer. But the downside is you do need to be careful when you are removing that guano, because if you sweep it up within an enclosed space, it could cause respiratory problems.
Yeah, and I was talking with Dr. Jerry Jackson about that. There's a certain, you were mentioning the nitrogen content, and that causes this.
Right, like all guano, all poop, whatever, there is a very high nitrogen content, and where that's allowed to build up, fungi get in, and one of the fungi that is very, very dangerous to humans is one that causes histoplasmosis, Histoplasma capsulatum. It's a fungus that is found primarily in the southeastern United States. It causes serious lung disease, and you breathe in the spores when you disturb the poop.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask also, Dr. Holly Ober, can you tell me a little bit about the Sugarloaf Key Bat Tower?
Attempt to create a large structure that the bats might use as a roost site, and the intent was to try to control mosquitoes on the key. I say it was a misguided attempt because the architect who built it didn't know a lot about what specifications the bats would prefer, and so a lot of money was spent building a large structure that was never actually inhabited by bats.
Did anything live there?
My guess is that some insects probably took up residence, some wasps. But fortunately, we know a lot more today about what bats like, and so there are a lot of blueprints available on the internet that provide guidance on how to build a successful bat house.
So, Dr. Jerry Jackson, there are 13 species of bats in the state year-round. 10 of those are in Southwest Florida all year, and their primary diet, as you mentioned before, is insects. What do you think would happen without bats?
Without bats, we would have a lot more insects and a lot of problems. There are other things that eat insects, too, and other things that eat mosquitoes, such as dragonflies. Dragonflies, both the adults and the larvae, eat mosquitoes. The larvae of dragonflies eat mosquito larvae. But mosquitoes are tiny insects. They carry a lot of diseases that affect humans and our pets and other animals. And keeping them under control naturally is important. Bats are one of the most important of natural controls for mosquitoes. The smaller bats in particular, like the eastern pipistrelle or the Mexican retail bat, they will eat as much as the equivalent of 3,000 mosquitoes per hour.
That's quite a bit.
Per night, I'm sorry.
How do they do on agricultural pests?
They do very well on agricultural pests. They eat lots of beetles, lots of plant bugs, and things like that. Every species of bat has its own food resource, its own preferences, its own habitats. Some bats are found near water, and those would feed a lot of mosquitoes. Other bats are found in forested areas. Some have very broad distributions. You mentioned bat houses and the problem with them or the importance of them in some sense. Bat houses usually are about 2 feet tall. They're sort of like a birdhouse, except there's no opening except at the bottom on the underside of it. And bats come up into the bat house from below. And what's inside are a series of rough boards. They have to be rough. They can't be sanded because the bat is going to cling to them, spaced half an inch to an inch or more apart. And the bats like to squeeze into those tight spaces. Most of the bat houses that you can get now are pretty good, but there used to be a lot of them for sale that had nice refined wood that was carefully sanded and were simply too small for the bats. But we even have had the Florida bonneted bat nesting, roosting in bat houses, a bat house up in North Fort Myers.
Oh, wow. Because I think that when I was looking into the Florida bonneted bat, and we'll talk about him a little bit more later, is that they weren't really sure about them and bat houses yet. They hadn't really figured that out.
There is one good record for a bat house in North Fort Myers. Has to be a big bat house and has to be one that provides a little bit more room. The smaller bats use smaller spaces in between the boards.
Yeah, it's a big
bat. And one of the bats that really will use them is the Mexican retail bat, which roosts in colonies and sometimes can include thousands of bats.
Yeah. So we are talking about bats in Florida and the protection granted them during their maternity season, which starts tomorrow and runs through August 15th. We're talking with Dr. Jerry Jackson, a zoologist and professor at FGCU, and with Dr. Holly Ober from the University of Florida. You can get involved in the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, as we were talking about the Florida bonneted bat, he's the largest bat in Florida. It's found only in South Florida. So I wanted to ask Dr. Ober, what happens if someone finds a bonneted bat roosting on their property? Can they contact someone?
Absolutely. If someone finds a bonneted bat or finds a bat that they suspect might possibly be a bonneted bat, they should definitely contact the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So in the state of Florida, we've got 13 species of bat total, and two of them are endangered. One of them is the gray bat, and it only occurs in a single cave up in the northern part of the state. And then the Florida bonneted bat occurs nowhere in the world but South Florida. So at the present time, we don't know a whole lot about it, but we think it occurs in just 14 counties in South Florida. So basically from Polk County on south to Miami-Dade County. And we have found the bonneted bats roosting in both live and dead palm trees, live and dead pine trees, also royal palm trees, bat houses, and people's buildings. So if you live in one of those counties between Polk and Miami-Dade and you find bats within a building, it's best to determine first whether they are a bonneted bat before you do any sort of exclusion.
So call the authorities first. And then once you do, if you do find that you do have a bonneted bat, what can you do? Is it, he's just going to live there?
Well, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service would provide advice on what the next steps should be.
Okay. So why is it endangered?
It is very rare. So we don't have an estimate of the number of individuals, but the last natural roost site that was found for bonneted bats was in 1979, and then not a single record was found for a bonneted bat natural roost until 2013. So we went decades without having a single record of a bat in a natural roost, a bonneted bat in a natural roost. Then the species was listed as federally endangered in 2013, so a lot of research effort has been put into learning more about the bonneted bats quickly because we know that they're at risk of extinction.
So we have two that are endangered, but then all bats, though, are protected during this maternity season, correct?
That's correct.
Yes. Is that because it might possibly be a bonneted or other endangered bat, or is it because it's just cruel to do that if there are pups inside?
Yeah, so bats in general have very low reproductive rates. Most bats across the country have just one pup per year, one per litter and one litter per year. In Florida, some of our bats have two pups per litter, but even still, they have a very slow reproductive rate. And so if you wipe out an entire colony by doing an exclusion at the wrong time of year, you could have a big impact on the local bat community. And then there's also the ethical issues of killing all of the innocent pups that are inside the building because you have prevented them from their food source, which is their mother returning with the milk.
I think our listeners might like to know a little bit about, you know, how do you identify a Florida bonneted bat when you see one? It's our largest bat. It has a wingspan of about 20 inches. Its body is only about 6 inches long. And it's called bonneted because its ears are large and they extend up over the top of the head, and they're connected at the base over the top of the head, making it look like a bonnet.
It kind of looks like a sunbonnet.
Yeah.
They're really cute.
So it's a quite large bat. They occur in small groups. We found some that were breeding a maternal colony up on the Babcock Webb Wildlife Management Area.
Can you get close enough to see them, though? I mean, are you looking through binoculars?
We could see them. They were within about 30 feet of us, maybe a little closer than that, but we were using binoculars also. One of the reasons why there is so little known about them is because they fly higher than most of the other bats.
Well, with wings like that.
They don't come down low. They're looking for larger insects up higher. Also, one of the reasons why they maybe have a very low population is because of loss of old growth forests. One of the first records of them in Florida was some that were found in a red cockaded woodpecker cavity in an old pine tree, and we suspect that that was probably a major roosting site that they used.
Mm-hmm. And they do it in groups there. We have a call coming in right now from Charlie in Lehigh Acres. Charlie, what would you like to ask?
Good morning. I appreciate the chance to talk to you this morning. I live out in Lehigh Acres in an area that was formerly known as the 12-mile slough on the edge of Lehigh. And historically, I've lived here about 26 years, and we used to have several kinds of bats out here. And at times they were quite prolific. And my question is, since I'm seeing the demise of other aspects of butterflies and dragonflies and frogs and other things, and also seeing hardly any bats anymore. I'm wondering if you'd care to comment on the effects of the mosquito control use of Naylin and how that affects both from the bats on down to the frogs.
Okay, so I guess, Holly Ober, Dr. Ober, do you know much about this particular type of mosquito control and how that might impact bats or all the way down to frogs, as you asked?
Not necessarily. I would say in general that one of the biggest causes of concern as far as biodiversity and wildlife in particular is concerned is habitat loss and habitat degradation. And some of that goes back to loss of roost structure, as Dr. Jerry Jackson was just mentioning, the loss of the larger pine trees that are important roost sites for some of the bats. But it also goes to degradation of the native ground cover that would support the insects that all of our bats feed on. And when we're talking about spraying insecticides, that of course has a very direct effect on the number of insects that are available to bats to feed on. And it also could have indirect effects if bats are feeding on insects that have been sprayed but have not yet died, and the bats are actually injecting the insecticides.
Have you seen any cases of that in which a bat has ingested insecticides and it's caused injury or death?
I'm not aware of anyone who has been studying that directly in Florida, no.
Okay. Are there any efforts underway in Florida agriculturally, at least to put appropriate bat houses near agricultural areas as a natural pest defense? Is anybody doing anything like that?
Absolutely. That's something that I actually recommend all the time. So I am an associate professor and also an extension specialist. So I do a lot of outreach events. And whenever I'm with an agricultural audience, I always recommend putting up bat houses because there's no way the bats are going to hurt you if you are in an agricultural setting, but there are very definite ways they could benefit you. So as Dr. Jerry Jackson was saying earlier, we know that a lot of the major agricultural crops that we've got in Florida are impacted by insects that the bats could potentially feed on. So things like the cabbage looper, the corn earworm, the fall armyworm, and the tobacco budworm, those are really big pests on crops such as corn and cotton, and the bats will eat those insects.
Yeah, we normally think of bats as catching flying insects and insects that are flying in the air, but they will find groups of caterpillars and things like the cabbage loopers that and actually land sometimes on the plant to eat the insect. It's very interesting. They're very diverse. They have a diverse number of methods of capturing the insects, and they consume lots of them. The issue of pesticides is an important one because it does reduce the diversity of life in an area, and as that happens, it's the food supply for somebody.
And, yeah, it's somebody's food,
and that somebody may be bats, and they may help keep the system – bats will help keep the system in balance.
Are bats good at – do they – when they land, do they have a hard time then taking off? Do they need to land in higher places in order to have some height before they jump off?
That's a really good point. Yes, they need open areas, particularly open areas – leading up to their roost sites. Some trees are adapted to be pollinated by bats, and those trees have their flowers at the tips of the branches and don't produce leaves nearby, making certain that the flowers are in the open where the bats can reach them by coming up from below.
And you're an ornithologist mainly.
Yes.
So it's kind of interesting that you know about the bat because it's kind of like the bird mammal, sort of, being
well,
that
flies. I've had graduate students who worked with bats, and I teach mammalogy. I've taught mammalogy for 30 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're adept at it, but then your specialty is the birds. And I found it weird when I was reading about this protection of bats because it kind of is similar to the protections that are afforded to birds that are migrating.
Yeah. They are.
But only in Florida.
But, well.
For bats.
Endangered species are protected throughout the nation. So the Indiana bat and the Florida bonneted bat and other endangered species of bats are protected by federal law. But the better protection that we have here in Florida for bats, and particularly during the maternal season, is something that we did here as a result of an understanding of the ecosystem and the needs of the creatures and understanding their life histories.
Yeah. So, Dr. Holly Ober, how long has this rule been in effect? I mean, has this been around for a long time?
I'm honestly not sure of the date that the rule went into play.
No, I was just curious because, I mean, it's pretty nice that we actually even recognize the importance of that.
Yes, and I think we should commend the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission for putting this rule in place because there are many other states that don't have such rules.
And one question that I wanted to ask, a lot of people associate mosquitoes and bats, that bats help get rid of mosquitoes. So I wanted to ask if there's any correlation between the possibility of Zika, of bats being able to have any kind of impact on the mosquito that carries Zika.
It's hard to say for sure. My understanding is that the mosquitoes that are associated with Zika are more active during the daytime, and our bats are all nocturnal. So there may not be a real direct link with the density of bats in an area and the density of mosquitoes that could potentially be carrying the Zika virus.
Yeah, maybe they just catch them at dusk and dawn. And I wanted to ask also about Lee County had a really big exclusion project recently when it removed a roost during the Matlache Bridge placement. Can you tell me anything about the bridges that these bats use to roost in? And do those cause problems?
The bats themselves should not be causing any sort of problem in the bridges, no. Again, these are the kinds of bats that would prefer to be living in large trees, but they can't find those cavities and crevices in the natural trees because many homeowners will cut down large dead and dying trees out of safety concerns. And so the bats have difficulty finding the natural structures that they would prefer, and so they're looking for man-made surrogates. So the bridges that the bats prefer tend to be the cement type that have seams where two cement blocks meet, and they will squeeze in between those joints and roost in there during the day.
And describe to me a bat roost, because when I was talking to you on the phone yesterday before we did this show, you said I kept on saying nesting, and you're like, no, they don't nest. So they don't make it homey. They don't add anything to it. They just kind of hang there, and that's it.
Right, and different species of bats have different preferences for the number of bats that they like to have within their roost. So there are some bats that live in the foliage who will live singly. They just roost alone. But then there are other bats at the other extreme, the Mexican free-tailed bat, that lives in colonies as large as several hundred thousand bats. So there are several large bat houses at the University of Florida campus in Gainesville, which each house 100,000 to 200,000 of these free-tailed bats.
So I wanted to ask you, we're kind of running low on time, but I wanted to ask you real quick, anecdotally, what do you say to people who find bats to be scary? I mean, they find fear whenever they see a bat.
I would say bats are among the coolest animals on the planet. They're the only mammals that can fly. They're one of the few mammals that is 100% nocturnal. Many of the others are active at sunset and sunrise, whereas the bats are only active after dark. And they're so unique in the way that they are able to use their echolocation to find minute insects to feed on and successfully capture enough of them to keep themselves well fed.
And Dr. Jerry Jackson, you have experience with a lot of different kinds of animals. Obviously, studying zoology, that pretty much covers it. But what do you think about bats and their place in the world?
Well, I think we've talked about their importance in controlling insect pests. They are also food for other kinds of creatures. There are falcons, for example, that will specialize on eating bats. Bats are eaten by humans in other parts of the country, especially the large fruit-eating bats that can have a wingspan of over 6 feet. We are just at the cusp of learning more about bats that's really important. The fruit-eating bats, we know that some of them can carry the Ebola virus, and it may be the reservoir for the Ebola virus. I've worked in Indonesia, and there you can go to Indonesia to a market and buy a bat to take home for dinner. And since they don't have much refrigeration there, you buy the live bat, and yeah. they have it hanging on a branch in the market by its feet, and its lips have been sewed shut so that it can't bite you.
Oh.
And it's got a tied around its wings so that it can't fly. Beautiful, beautiful bats. But there are some downsides, and the Ebola virus is one. Our bats don't have that. That's not – it's a total different group of bats. But our bats do carry rabies, and some of the strains of rabies that bats have do not kill the bat. So if you find a bat that is sick or injured, it's best to use gloves when handling it and be very, very careful. You don't have to get bitten to get rabies. You can get it from coming into contact with the bodily fluids of the bat.
Well, that's a good tip to leave on. And I'm sure Dr. Ober did not love hearing the story about Indonesia. So we're going to have to leave it there for today now. But thanks to our guests, Dr. Holly Ober from University of Florida and Dr. Jerry Jackson with FGCU. Thanks so much for shedding a little light on our nocturnal friend. I really appreciate it. Coming up, what do shelter animals and fine dining have in common? We'll have a look at First Bite, an event that's designed to kick off summer and drive locals to restaurants and local charities during the slow season. We'll be right back.